This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, chapters 27 and 28, The Lightning-Struck Tower and The Flight of the Prince. In these chapters, the thing Jess has been dreading has come to pass.
Damn it. I don't even know what to say.
And we figure out who the Half-Blood Prince is.
Yeah.
You're so enthused. And joining us this evening is Lord Paramount of the East across the pond, the warden herself, Natalia Ward. Yay!
Hi. Yay!
Yay! Yay! Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's two of my favorite chapters of this book. So I was like, I definitely need to come in here and talk about it.
Yes. That's, I mean, it's kind of devastating though, because it's like,
yeah,
the saddest thing ever.
Oh, I am super morbid. I like the really morbid bit. So even when I was in, when I was Catholic in church, I really liked the Book of Revelations, which is like right at the end where there's all the apocalypse and stuff that. And, you know, every time that I used to watch Titanic, I used to fast forward to I used to put the second tape, you know, when Titanic wasn't a tape and you used to put it. Yeah,
I used to put it. Rewind.
Tape. Yeah, I used to put the second tape in to watch the ship go down. So I love like all the morbid stuff.
Which I'm really the drama,
head, I guess. Yeah, I live for the drama.
That's all right.
Yes. And before we get too far in, I want to make a quick, you know, I made a point of mentioning in the last episode that Russia had attacked Poland. It has since come out that the Ukrainians admit that it was their missile, a misfire or something, that happened to hit Poland by mistake, so that it was not Russia, and therefore World War III will not be commencing yet.
Great.
As of this moment of reporting.
As of this moment of November 21st, 2022.
Right.
And because, again, that just would have been so ironic that all the shit starts because of Poland again.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Yeah.
The
like, what is Poland? Like, the Waffle House of the world?
I know.
The Waffle House parking lot where people are fighting.
Yes.
I love that. I mean, it's so sad, but yeah. I'm glad we're not going to war just yet, because I was already looking at tickets to go back to Brazil because I want to be as far away from this as possible. So I was like, I could just shove it on the credit card. And I'll go live in Brazil for a while.
Yes. That's smart. So, very poignant chapter. I can understand, Nat, why you wanted to join us for this chapter. But again, Jess, this was something you knew was coming, you knew were spoiled on, but you didn't know exactly how it was going to happen or exactly when it was going to happen. And especially because you are, you know, I could best be described as a hardcore, you know, Dumbledore fan.
Love me some Dumbledore. I knew this book was so much of him, which he's just kind of like popped in and been poignant at the other books, and then he like disappears. I'm like, there is so much Dumbledore in these books. He's leaving. The way his death played out, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. But the title of this chapter is, like you had mentioned, it's one of the tarot cards, which the tower usually is a pretty big moment. So I knew, I had a feeling when we talked about this title, I'm like, oh man, this is going to be it. So, yeah, I don't know how much you want me to say other than I read this today and I was like devastated and then I had to continue my day. So no wonder I'm reading Colleen Hoover right now. I have to recover.
Yes, there's no more legend and lattes. Got to go to Colleen Hoover.
I bounce around. I don't know what kind of reader I am, but
For all of our listeners who want a cozy fantasy about an orc putting aside her bounty hunter life to open a coffee shop, read Legends and Lattes.
Yeah, it's very cute.
Is that our story, Amy?
Oh, or from when we go off to, when we run off to Edinburgh to open up the cupcake cauldron?
Yeah. Yeah, that I'm so close to doing that. I'm just saying fuck it and doing it.
The Cupcake Cauldron, Book Bistro, and Cat Cafe.
Yeah, yeah. That's
and then we're just going to create our own Diagon Alley.
Yeah. Well, we'll open it on the place that was inspired, that author mm-hmm. was inspired to do Diagon Alley from.
Mm-hmm. As said, the ghostwriter, because Harry wrote these books.
Yes, the ghostwriting.
Yep. So, chapter 27, The Lightning Struck Tower. So, again, we're getting some real role reversal where Harry is having to be responsible for Dumbledore, who is incredibly weakened from drinking the green Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
In the Lake Cave of Doom.
Like Slimer juice. That just reminded me of, like, wasn't that like a thing, a Kool-Aid back in the day that was green?
Yeah, because when I, you know, posed the schedule to you, Nat, I was wondering, like, will she want the Dumbledore death chapter or will she want the cave chapter? And then you ultimately did Dumbledore's death. And so I'm like, all right.
No, it's always going to be the death. Like, you know, if you're ever going to put me down for any future recordings, it's always going to be the death. Any death. I'm so morbid.
It's a big deal. This one's a big deal.
Yeah. Yep. So Harry... Again, Harry's no Hermione, so the fact that he pulled this off is quite miraculous to me. That he gets Dumbledore back to Hogsmeade, you know, seemingly unscathed. And first is like, okay, I need to get you up to the hospital wing and get you to Madame Pomfrey. And Dumbledore's like, no, it's Professor Snape who I need. And he first tries to go to Madame Rosmerta, the Three Broomsticks, to get... to have Dumbledore rest, but Madame Rosmerta comes out and is flailing around, like, haven't you seen it? And they look up in the sky, and what's in the sky, Jess?
Oh, man, the death mark or whatever. What is it called?
The dark mark.
The dark mark.
Yes, the dark mark, which is shining over specifically the astronomy tower. And this seems to re-energize Dumbledore. Pure adrenaline, probably, and is like, give us some brooms. We need to go there now.
I was wondering about the, like, the visual of this, because, like, Dumbledore's pretty, like, out of it at this point. So he's like, you know, I don't know.
He's so out of it that Harry's, like, looking side-eyeing to making sure he doesn't have to, like, literally grab Dumbledore from falling off the broom falling into the sky.
Ugh. That's trouble. That's trouble. But.
His white girl wasted.
Yeah, so, and Dumbledore orders him to put on his invisibility cloak. They fly up to the tower. Dumbledore is removing all of the enchantments around, you know, like, I imagine it's this big magical, like, bubble that you wouldn't be able to cross unless, you know, Dumbledore is removing all of them so that they can, you know, enter the Hogwarts radius quickly. And so, and Harry's freaking out because he's like, you know, because traditionally the Dark Mark is only cast after the Death Eaters have committed a murder, that there has been a death. And so Harry's, all sorts of horrible things are going through Harry's mind about, like, who could it have been? Did I send someone to their death by telling Ron and Hermione and the others to patrol the hallways? And so is he also all going to be responsible again for someone, for his friend's death? What were you thinking, Jess, in terms of what exactly could be going down?
Okay, so I know one of the Weasley brothers dies, and I don't remember which book it's in. So I thought, like, okay, they're going to walk up on that. And to be fair, like we don't know yet. We know there's this one very specific thing. I don't think they've like to, because to me this was just like mass chaos and possible carnage. So there could be somebody else that has died, but we don't know. We just do know that the Death Eaters are at Hogwarts, even though we thought like we couldn't get there. But good old Malfoy helped them get in.
Yes. And so they land in the astronomy tower. Nothing's going on. And Dumbledore's like, go and wake Severus. Tell him what has happened and bring him to me. Do nothing else. Speak to nobody else. And do not remove your cloak. I shall wait here.
Yeah, because he's having a hard time. And Harry's kind of like, Harry, again, is like, are you serious? Like, that's who you want me to get? You know, like, and you kind of, as the reader, you're like, what? Okay.
Well, yeah, because he's also, Dumbledore's already admitted that when he was cursed by the ring, it was Severus, it was Snape who, you know, prevented the thing from spread, prevented it from spreading, and also with Katie Bell, that, right. So it's kind of been established that, it's kind of already been established to Harry multiple times by Dumbledore that Snape is the go-to, like, dark arts medic, which is, if that potion wasn't classified under the dark arts, I don't know what is.
Right, right, yeah. So that's kind of where I rationalized it. Like, okay, it was like a potion that's kind of got him messed up. But I know Harry is always kind of like, and I think in this scene, he's like, I can run and get Madam. And he's like, no, this is who I need. Go get them. So...
yeah. How did you feel, you know, just starting up this chapter, Nat?
Oh, I just love this chapter. It's just so, I don't know. It you feel everything. It paints like such a great picture about, you know, everything that has gone on, and especially when you have reread everything. So I just picked this up, you know, opened it in this chapter. Mm-hmm. And then everything that has happened in the previous chapter came back to me, and you're right there. You're right there when Harry apparates in Hogsmeade, and in the horror that you feel when they see the Dark Mark. Yeah, and everything else that, you know, is about to go down. That's all I can say, is just you really feel the whole chapter.
It's very tense.
Indeed. And so, but before Harry can go get anyone, Snape or otherwise, the door bursts open. Harry still has his cloak, and he feels a freezing charm on him. And he's first confused because the new person screamed Expelliarmus, not like Impedimenta or whatever. And then he realizes that Dumbledore used his last millisecond to freeze Harry before being disarmed by the newcomer.
Yeah, yeah.
And who is it but Draco frickin' Malfoy?
A man on a mission.
On a mission. And, you know, you've been very critical of Harry, you know, these past chapters, Jess, about his obsession with Malfoy. But ultimately, he was right in terms of the level of depravity that Draco was up to. And we get the whole, you know... again, a lot of people criticize in movies and books about the big evil, the evil explaining the big evil speech from the villain.
Yeah.
But in this context, you know, I'm okay with it. It makes sense because, you know, it makes sense why Draco would want to explain all this and say how fabulous he is, because he's trying to delay the inevitable. And so it makes sense why he's engaging with this sort of conversation. With Dumbledore, because he really, really doesn't want to do what's being asked of him. Whereas with other villains and their drama queen, you know, villain speeches, it's just like, you know, just shut up and do it.
Right.
But here it's actually very relevant and makes sense why he's engaging in this way.
Yeah, he's stalling because he doesn't really want to do it. He's very like, so this is giving him the opportunity to kind of like puff his chest, but then also like stall the action. He doesn't truly want to take, like, as badass as he thinks he is, there's just that. I was so worried I was about to eat my words, because I said I don't think Draco's a murderer, and as I'm reading this, I'm like, ah, damn, I shouldn't have said that. But you know, it was interesting.
Well, if you look at it, it's more like Dumbledore is sort of you know, well, I knew all of this. So he's the one sort of leading Draco into revealing his plans by right. saying, yeah, I knew that you were doing all of this anyway. And I think that's a tactic to, you know, oh, you're not as smart as you think you are, and you're still a child, and like there's still salvation for you. Just don't do this. And you can see that it starts to get to Draco, to being like, well, this man knew all along and he didn't do anything because he was trying to protect me, as Dumbledore says.
This is very interesting because I have some thoughts about Dumbledore's fate here, and I know, you know, what plays out. It's almost like he's provoking him to make sure like Harry can hear this. I mean, because otherwise, like the stalling information, like he's got, you know, Dumbledore, smartest wizard alive. He knows what he's doing. Like mm-hmm. even though, I mean, I think he knows his fate too. So anyway, we'll get there.
Yeah. So we go into this. Yeah. Dumbledore admits, you almost killed Katie Bell and Ronald Weasley. You have been trying with increasingly desperation to kill me all year. Forgive me, Draco, but they have been feeble attempts. So feeble, to be honest, that I wondered whether your heart has really been in it. And I guess, you know, there is a sense of, again, you're not a, you know, Dumbledore being all like, you're not a killer, Draco. But Harry the writer portrays Draco as being this tortured soul put in this impossible position, you know. But at the same time, like, the level of gross negligence that Katie could have died, Ron yeah. could have died. There comes a point when gross negligence becomes just as bad as malicious intent.
Yeah.
So in terms of this whole portraying Draco as, again, this, you know, tragic child of Nazis, you know, forced into a position, did he really have a choice up until this point? But at the same time, like, he could have done some really serious damage.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But yeah.
I mean, not to be a Draco apologist or anything, but he was doing everything that he could out of desperation at the end of the day. Yeah. You know, as he says, I think in the next page or so, that he was like, he was going to kill me, you know, I was going to die trying to kill you. If I failed at any point, he was going to kill me. So he was doing all of this out of desperation, but, you know, in this out of desperation, you know, actions, he was really sloppy because he never killed someone before in his life. So right. it's not like he knew how to do it in a sneaky way, which that's what he had to do anyway, you know, to kill Dumbledore, the most powerful wizard anyone has ever seen. So yeah, he was a desperate kid that didn't know what he was doing. And to your point, Amy, actually, he just didn't really care that yeah. you know, those people were affected, especially not Ron, since he's like a mudblood sympathizer or whatever.
Yeah, or Katie Bell. And it makes me, you know, you going through all that, and again, the level part of it also, I think, is just level of maturity of, again, when you're engaging in those sorts of like poisonings or like indirect ways of assassination, mm-hmm. it allows you to desensitize, you know, what you're doing. And Draco, yeah. I think, is immature enough to, you know, not think through, because it makes me think of there was an instance where a woman wanted to hire a hitman to like kill her husband or whatever, and it ended up being like not directly a honey trap, but basically it was a fake hitman that she was talking to, and, you know, incriminated herself, and that guy, you know, went to the police, and basically, you know, the only defense, you know, she got a certain amount of, you know, time in jail, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I think one commentator, one psychologist was basically like, you know, she's just really, really, really immature that, like, what she couldn't compute, that what she was saying could, you know, become actions.
Yeah.
Which is something that can happen, again, if you're not doing it directly, when you're mm-hmm. engaging in off, you know, in indirect forms of assassination.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of Joe Exotic, that's another example. you know, he goes online just, you know, randomly talking to someone like, can you kill this lady? And it's, you know, it's just not computing. And then he's so surprised that he is up and on trial for planning to kill Carol Baskins. But he has been threatening to kill her in, like, live on his, like, you know, internet shows and his video shows on YouTube. And it's like, you're just not thinking things through, are you?
Yeah. Or again, in those instances where people with platforms, like a certain orange former president, inciting a mob.
Right. Yeah.
You know, again, and what is your level of responsibility and agency in causing that to happen when you incite violence via your rhetoric online?
Yeah. Well, same with, like, poor Nancy Pelosi's husband. That was, like, all the rhetoric around that was, like, you know, the people, I forget those two idiots' names, the two women and the senator, whatever. I don't want to mention their names. I can't think of them. I don't want to mention them. Anyway, I'm trying to think of the brunettes. I remembered one of their names. Anyway, they were saying, like, Nancy Pelosi, you know, is whatever. And people who commit treasonous acts, the punishment for treason is execution. So they never said, like, go kill Nancy Pelosi. It's just this is a thing that happens. And then it inspires some wacko to, you know, go injure her husband. So,
Yeah.
Be careful what you say.
Yeah, because literally, it wasn't supposed to be her husband. It was supposed to be, you know, her. And the guy was going to be like, you know, basically torture her into confessing whatever and be using, having the sledgehammer or whatever to break her kneecaps if necessary.
Good God. Yeah. These people are out of control.
I know. I was listening to My Favorite Murder, and they were talking about that and the fact that these people are using Christianity and, like, Jesus's teaching justify what they are doing. It's horrible because, you know, growing up Catholic, you know, you are taught that, like, Jesus's, you know, teachings are, you know, love thy neighbor and, you know, do unto others what you would like done to yourself or something like that, because, you know, I'm a very good Christian. I remember everything. And it's like these people are actually, like, celebrating hurting another person and celebrating the fact that this person nearly got killed. Is just that is just not anything that the church has taught you.
No.
Yeah, for listeners, I have many recommendations of nonfiction books about the rise of the Christian nationalist movement, which is very disturbing and alarming. I've read several of them, some from opposing left-leaning commentators and also ones from inner, like, moderate conservative critics as well, and evangelicals who criticize it. But yeah, that's a whole mess in itself. But I digress. Again, just the notion, again, of Malfoy engaging in the desensitization of what he is doing because he was engaging in a lot of indirect forms of violence and assassinations. Mm-hmm. So we get to the point where, you know, Draco's explaining, ultimately, the way he does this and what he's been doing is he was repairing in the Room of Requirement the Vanishing Cabinet, which we knew of from the previous book because some Slytherin, Fred or George, shoved him in a vanishing cabinet and they literally did not know where he went or what happened. He just showed up, like, in a toilet, like, a week later or several weeks later. And, you know, that guy, again, was it Montague?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was Montague. I was like, something Shakespearean, Montague. And the Montagues and the Capulets and Romeo and Juliet. Anyway.
Yeah.
So he, in his experience, Draco was able to piece together that there was some sort of portal because Montague could hear what was going on at Hogwarts, but also could hear at some points what was going on in Borgin and Burks. And then finally he escaped by apparating himself out, even though he had never freaking apparated in his life. And so people just assumed what he heard was, like, nonsense, was gobbledygook. But Draco was the one that pieces it together that, oh, these two are a pair, and there's a connection, there's a pathway between them. I'm going to use that to smuggle my people into the school, which is pretty ingenious because literally there's, like, again, there's the gates, there's the, obviously, there, again, I imagine this huge invisible force field bubble just surrounding this castle and the grounds. Like, the only other entrance I can possibly think of is we don't know the extent or the nature of the perimeter of the Forbidden Forest.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I once read a fan fiction which was entirely based on Draco actually accepting Dumbledore's help.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and actually at some point in that fan fiction, like, going into like the parameters of the forest and Draco explaining, yeah, I was going all year trying to figure out how to, like, smuggle these people, and I know exactly all the possible ways you can or cannot get in. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but that was again, once you finish the series, Jess, I highly recommend that one. It is a Draco Hermione fic, but
okay. I was gonna say, then I can explore that. I feel like I might have, I was saying last time I watched the scene where they were in the cave, you know, and then I watched Dumbledore's death scene. And I feel like I was like, I shouldn't have done that. I mean, I can separate the two, but it was very different how it was portrayed in the movie, which was kind of irritating to me. But anyway, yeah. We'll clear it.
So anyway, and even, you know, Dumbledore concedes that that was pretty clever because obviously he knew that Draco was behind the necklace, behind the wine, but he didn't know exactly this nature of the vanishing cabinets, because again, there is this sense of, you know, Dumbledore explaining that I didn't, like, say anything or apprehend you or say anything to you because I knew that if I tipped off that I knew anything, that Voldemort would kill you at once. But he is conceding I didn't know the vanishing cabinet. I'm wondering if Dumbledore, if he knew how successful Draco was going to be in terms of being able to smuggle very dangerous people, yeah. you know, and possibly, you know, put everyone in, you know, Hogwarts in possible danger, because it's not just this one teenage kid anymore where I can control him. I can manipulate him, have him see reason. But if he had known that, oh, he has this vanishing cabinet and he's just going to bring on full on Death Eaters into the castle, then I wonder if he would have acted differently, or if he had, what if he possibly would have done anything different in terms of delaying this trip to the cave or what.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question.
No, I think it's a massive oversight of the vanishing cabinets. It's something that it's very unlike Dumbledore to not know the functions of everything that he has in the castle, even though it is, like, in the Room of Requirement. But yeah, it's a very weird oversight.
Yeah, because I think
if he knew, he would have moved that or destroyed it completely, just like he did with the Mirror of Erised when, you know, he caught Harry, like, staring at it in first year. He moved that to another place so he wouldn't, like, reach it.
Yeah, like, if I were headmaster and I would take a house elf and be like, go into the specifically Room of Requirement, the Room of Hidden Things, and take an inventory of absolutely everything.
Yeah,
that would probably be them.
I mean, a few house elves. Yeah, it's just a bit of a mess over there.
It is literally 10 centuries worth of hidden crap.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Maybe they wouldn't. The inventories would have to be, like, kind of constant. Like, geez, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Every
5 or 10 years or so, go back in there, see if anything has changed. Right. I hate to be that house elf.
Yeah, that's like me trying to re-itemize all the books in my program's library.
God, that's awful.
Yeah. So we get past the vanishing cabinets. And then we get into this debate about Snape. And it's like, he's a double agent, you stupid old man. He isn't working for you. You just think he is. We must agree to differ on that, Draco.
First of all, don't call Dumbledore a stupid old man. Draco, shut your mouth. second of all, which I love that, like, Dumbledore is kind of, like, out of it. And he's like, don't say mudblood in front of me. I thought that was a very classy move. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, and then, oh, Madame Rosebud has been under the Imperius curse.
That makes sense, I guess, because she was using that, you know, the Dark Mark as a diversion and like, oh, look over there. Like, oh,
yeah.
So.
Yep, and then you care about me saying mudblood when I'm about to kill you? Yes, I do. But as for being about to kill me, Draco, you have had several long minutes now. We are quite alone. I am more defenseless than you could have dreamed of finding me, and still you have not acted. Which, again, very, very telling. So, I guess Harry the writer has just, I feel like he's kind of been building up that Draco could be capable of this level of depravity, of villainy, because even in second year with the Chamber of Secrets, it's really creepy the way Draco's like, the last time the Chamber of Secrets have opened, a mugblood died. This time I hope it's Granger. And then in the fifth book, he shows this eagerness of, you know, being so excited when Umbridge is about to torture Harry. So like, he's shown in Harry's writing as having this tendency for really cruel, cruel things. But when push comes to shove, when he has to do it.
That's such like a typical, speaking of the orange one, that's such a typical like bully move. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm going to push and push, but I'm never going to get my hands dirty. And that is something that orange one has been, you know, criticized for. I mean, he's an asshole and he says all these nasty things, but he's done a pretty good job of like, I mean, I say that, I take that back. He's a sexual assailant. So he has definitely done bad things. But, you know, for his other crimes, he's really good at having other people do his dirty work. He's like a mafia boss, right? That's kind of what they do.
Makes Watergate look like a tea party.
Oh, yeah. I think, yeah, you said it exactly right, Jess. It's one thing for someone to, you know, say these things and it's like, oh, yeah, haha, it's, you know, all these horrible, horrible things. But at the end of the day, when it comes to put your money where your mouth is, they will always just run away. I mean, Draco was always, he wasn't attacking like Harry himself. He would go and tell and make like a Crabbe and Goyle do it. You know, it's things like that, that, you know, he's more of a, the only difference between, I guess, Draco or the orange one and a mafia boss is that the mafia boss had to do all these things to become a mafia boss.
That's so very true.
So they do, you know, they do know how to do the business first.
That's true.
So yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And now we get to a point where Dumbledore is saying, like, we can help you, Draco. We can, you know, we can hide you. We can fake your death. Like, we can go, I can have members of the Order of the Phoenix pick up your mother tonight. You know,
right.
You know, there is a way out of this. And Malfoy is wavering, he's fudging, but before he can fully act on Dumbledore's offer, boom, the other Death Eaters burst in. And they are Death Eaters that we have not met before. We have Amicus and Alecto.
The hell?
Yeah, yeah. Amicus. And again, Amicus and Alecto is the woman, and Amicus is the guy. And then we have this blonde Death Eater. It isn't Lucius Malfoy, but we don't know who it is. And we have Fenrir Greyback at last, the legendary werewolf that bit Remus Lupin.
Nasty, nasty. A very different werewolf than Lupin.
Yes. Yeah. What did you... Because even, you know, Dumbledore, like, with Draco and, like, the other Death Eaters, you know, he's playing his, you know, we're just talking over tea. Like, we're just having a stroll in the park. Like, you know, that's how he dealt with Voldemort. That's how he deals with these situations. But even he is unable really to hide his disgust towards, you know, Fenrir Greyback.
I think it's like very important to remember that it's the actions that the person has taken, or, you know, the werewolf has in this case has taken, not the like, not the entity himself. Like, it's not that the fact that it's a werewolf that he's disgusted. It's the fact that he's a werewolf and like revels in it and does all the nastiness. And
he revels in it, and he doesn't even wait for his transformation anymore to prey on human flesh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Dumbledore's kind of like, you nasty like thing. You've got like, now you just like love the taste. And he's like, yeah, do. Like, it's very gross.
No, and the fact that he likes eating children, that's the, you know. And, right. And the thing is, you know, Dumbledore says, you know, I'm surprised, it said to Draco, I'm surprised that you would let him, you know, in the school where your friends are. And he was like, I didn't want him here. So, like, he's just grotesque to everyone.
Yeah, he's grotesque to everyone, which, again, which is so ironic of, you know, Draco having... attempting to defend himself to Dumbledore about Fenrir Greyback when he, in fact, was using Fenrir Greyback as a weapon to keep Borgin in line about the Vanishing Cabinet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, it's one of those things where, you know, it's all right when you're you know, running your mouth, but when it's time to do it,
right?
Where are you?
And so they're like, okay, Draco, do it now. And... Draco's still waffling, and then boom, who shows up finally? Severus Snape, our favorite gothic emo incel.
He's here.
Speak for yourself.
do you have a favorite gothic emo incel in literature, Nat?
Not in literature, but in fiction, I guess. Star Wars is Kylo Ren.
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. They got a big reaction from me.
A bit keen. Then,
blessing. Yes. Oh,
John Oliver would agree with you because he is fucking obsessed with that. With, what's
so
his
would
name?
Allie Hazelwood.
What was it? What's his name?
Adam Driver.
Yeah. Adam Driver.
He look like him. Their he cats has... look like him. Have you seen the cats that look
yes,
like him?
I have.
That's yeah, no. Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah, John Oliver has a huge man crush on Adam Driver. And there's a point where Adam Driver does show up on his show. Like
that was pretty great.
I mean, Adam Driver would have been a perfect Snape.
Yeah,
I think, like, you know, for the age that Snape was actually supposed to be, which is my age. That's disgusting. You know, in the beginning of Philosopher's Stone. Anyway,
not cool. Yeah, that's one thing I'm thinking when I look at these again. Obviously, they overaged everyone from the Marauders generations in the films. Not that I can throw shade at Alan Rickman ever, because he's just iconic.
Yeah, that's the problem as well with Snape, because people watch the movies. People who haven't, you know, read the books and seen how much of, like, so much nastier Snape is. Oh, yeah. But then they like Snape because of Alan Rickman, and my boyfriend's one of those. He's just, I said, what do you like about Snape? He's like, it's Alan Rickman. And I'm like, no, what do you like about Snape? Not Alan Rickman. He's like, oh, it's Alan Rickman though. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, it's because I went through a whole there's a YouTube channel, Cinema Therapy. Highly recommend any listeners go watch it, where a filmmaker and a therapist get to, they're like friends from college. They created a channel where they discuss various psychological concepts via film and other media. And they do have a whole one on Snape about, again, the discrepancy between film Snape and book Snape, because, again, of the adoration people have for Alan Rickman. And it's just like, yeah, basically it's almost like two different Snapes. But anyway, so Snape comes in, and Snape said nothing, but walked forward and pushed Malfoy roughly out of the way. The three Death Eaters fell back without a word. Even the werewolf seemed cowed. Snape gazed for a moment at Dumbledore, and there was revulsion and hatred etched in the harsh lines of his face. Severus, please. Yep, and then he says the dreaded words. And a jet of green light shot from the end of Snape's wand and hit Dumbledore square in the chest. Harry's scream of horror never left him silent and unmoving. He was forced to watch as Dumbledore was blasted into the air. For a split second, he seemed to hang suspended beneath the shining skull, and then he fell slowly backward like a great rag doll over the battlements and out of sight. So it's just a sense of, it's not just hit him with the spell and he drops, like, on the floor of the tower. Like, there's so much force in this spell that it knocks Dumbledore's body over the battlements and into the night.
Yeah.
Like. Yeah, and if you think about as well when Bellatrix said in Order of the Phoenix, where she said you need to have intention. Can you imagine how much intention and hatred Snape was feeling at that moment to be able to knock Dumbledore back, that he's like almost suspended in the air before he fell off the tower?
Okay. I have some thoughts.
So thoughts, Jess, do give them all to us.
So I feel like it has been hammered into the reader's brain that Dumbledore says, I trust Severus Snape completely. Like, okay, we get that. So I think as a reader, you're supposed to read this up. This is a huge betrayal. Like, I mean, I think what is interesting to note is there, okay, Snape gazed at Dumbledore for a moment and there was revulsion and hatred etched into the harsh lines of his face, of Snape's face, right? We don't talk about the reaction Dumbledore had in any capacity here. So, you know, he says, Severus, please. Is that a Severus, like, Severus, please? Or is it like, Severus, please, like, just do it, you know? And you're talking about the hatred coming out, you know, it, not necessarily toward Dumbledore. It could be just a, maybe it's toward Harry. I mean, shit, I don't know. But
he doesn't know that Harry's there. Harry's in the
God damn it. See, this is why I shouldn't watch that freaking movie scene, because he's like looking at Harry. I'm like, what is happening here? Okay, yeah, you're right. He doesn't know. Nobody knows but that Harry's there. So I have to say, when I first read it, I was like, Snape? Really? And then I read it again and I was like, oh, okay, there's got to be more to this. Like, I don't think Snape is just maliciously, like, throwing swagger. Like, there's a promise that was made and adhered to. So there's more to the story. I'm pissed Dumbledore's dead, but I'm... And like I've said this whole time we've been reading this, people love Snape for some dumb reason, and I don't know what it is, but I have a feeling he would not be as loved if, like, he killed Dumbledore just for the hell of it, so... Those are my thoughts right now.
I mean, there are some crazy people out there who, like, love the Dark Mark and love, like, the Death Eaters as well.
I love that Nancy Pelosi's husband was attacked.
Exactly.
I'm going to go get the Dark Mark tattooed on my arm. Like, you know. No. Some people have that, though, I think.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Quite a few people do. Like,
it's wild to me. I mean, no disrespect, but it feels... I mean, if you really read, you know, the context within the books, what the Dark Mark means, it means, like, supremacy. It's, like, wizard supremacy. If you translate it into real life, is white supremacy. And
it's the swastika.
Yeah.
You're basically getting the swastika tattooed on you. Yeah. No shade to anyone. But just, like, read.
Shade to Nazis.
Like, it's not. I mean, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, but, no shade to anyone who got the tattoo. But, you know, I guess what we're doing is, like, looking way beyond, right, what the books mean and what the symbolisms and stuff like that. But anyway.
Devastating. What the hell. And then this whole drama that happens next is insanity.
Yeah. And we move on to chapter 28, Flight of the Prince. And it takes a moment for Harry to realize that the spell that Dumbledore had him under has been uplifted. And he's just rooted to the spot based on, like, shock and horror and, like, in the denial phase of, like, that did not just happen. My brain cannot compute what just happened.
Right. Yeah.
But finally, he has a sense of... to follow the Death Eaters, to start shooting spells, and Harry follows after them. Complete chaos, complete battle going on, stepping over bodies and pools of blood, and no time to investigate.
Yeah, this is intense. And then...
Yeah. The only description is he sees Ginny, you know, zigzagging, unlike Rickon Stark, you know, to avoid, you know, a Death Eater's curse, and him and Harry, you know, incapacitating said Death Eater. But then, you know, keep going over, and he sees Professor McGonagall's fighting, Tonks is fighting, and he sees Neville on the ground, And Neville's like, I'm all right. Snape Malfoy ran past. Because Neville's not dumb. Like, you know, Harry is so desperate and screaming, like, where's, like, Snape and things like that. And Neville's like, they went that way.
Right. Right.
Like, oh. Neville is, again, none of us deserve Neville.
No.
He is so precious.
Hey. Especially not hot Neville either.
Yeah.
Amen.
Yep. And then so he goes down, and first he's really confused because it's like, would they go to the front doors? Would they try to go back to the room of requirement? But he sees a bloody footprint going in a direction away from the room of requirement, and therefore he infers from that, okay, somehow the room of requirement is blocked right now. And so he takes his little, like, shortcuts and zigzags through, like, tapestries and some secret passageways and shows up kind of near the Hufflepuff common room entrance, like, where the kitchens are. And Ernie's like, what the hell is going on? And Harry's like, not now!
Yeah, he's a man on a mission. I think I said that earlier, but it's my, like, favorite expression. But,
a man on a mission.
Pissed at Snape.
Pissed at Snape. Sees the Death Eaters run out, and then he sees that some of the Death Eaters are engaged in combat with Hagrid.
Just freaking lay off Hagrid. I didn't need to lose him, too. I didn't, thankfully. Close yeah. with Fang, but...
And, yeah, because luckily, Hagrid, again, he's so tough because of his giant's blood that all these spells that the Death Eaters are throwing are just, like, ricocheting off him. Like, it's
Good.
Nothing.
Good.
Yeah, but then, even though Hagrid himself seems pretty okay, his hut catches fire.
And Fang's in there.
Yep, and Fang's in there. And Harry's running after Snape and Draco. And Harry is screaming curses. And it gets to a point where Snape tells Draco to run and turns towards Harry.
And it's kind of sad because, like, Harry's, like, shooting this, and Snape's just like, pew, pew, they're just, like, flinging off of him, you know? It's like, he's like, stop, you know, you're not, you can't do, you know, stop trying to do this. It's not going to be successful against me.
Mm-hmm. And says, fight back, you cowardly coward, did you call me Potter? Your father would never attack me unless it was 4-on-1. What would you call him, I wonder? I can't. It's a sense of, again, he's committed this huge act and blown his cover as a double agent. And the thing that goes to his mind is, like, he should be thinking, I'm such a badass. I killed the greatest wizard of the 20th century. And still, he is so petulant that all he can think about is this rivalry he had with this kid's dad.
Like, how many years ago? How old is Harry? 17?
16.
16.
Grow the fuck up. Like, for when they were in school, like 20 years ago.
Okay. Like, dude, get some therapy. Get the fuck over it. Like, geez. I mean, I understand, like, but that really gets him, like, pretty riled up, is to call him a coward. He gets real pissed about it.
Yes. And Harry, you know, he keeps trying to throw things at him, and Snape's just like, blocked again and again and again until you learn to keep your mouth shut and your mind closed, Potter.
Damn.
And then Harry gets hit with the torturing curse, the Cruciatus curse, but it's not Snape, it's another Death Eater.
Yeah.
And Snape's like, no, he's the Dark Lord's, we're supposed to leave him.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And even Harry pushes himself up and he's going towards Snape, the man now he hated as much as he hated Voldemort himself, and tries to use Sectum Sempra. Doesn't work, and even tries to use Levicorpus, and Harry doesn't say it, he's just thinking it. He's like, he's literally in the mid-thought, Levy, and even Snape can sense it and is like, no.
Yeah.
And so Harry's flung, you know, backwards. And here's interesting. You dare use my own spells against me, Potter. It was I who invented them. I, the Half-Blood Prince. And you turn my inventions on me like your filthy father, would you? I don't think so. So this revelation, Jess.
Thought. It makes sense. It makes sense now. Because it was like all the potions, right? That's what he was like, Snape was like, a potion guy. And then when you think about that curse where he's slashing people's faces and it's for my enemies, that does give the very, like, it is very fitting with of like a teenage Snape, you know, like so the fact that he now, why he's calling himself the Half-Blood Prince, like, I guess he's a petty asshole. So like, or he's just,
why does this random guy with daddy issues call himself Lord Voldemort?
Right. Yeah. I would like to know I'm sure there's more behind his stupid prince self name, but I wasn't totally floored that it was Snape. I also feel like Hermione's going to be pretty psyched that she's like, you know, I don't know. She's going to feel pretty proud of herself. Yeah, very much so. But she also was going to make an argument that it was a girl, and it was not. Sorry, Hermione.
No. And Harry's like, kill me then. Kill me like you killed him, you coward. And again, as you said, Jess, this particular word seems to really trigger Snape because he just completely loses his shit.
Yeah, so what happened here? We'll find out.
Again, maybe. For a man who just committed murder, like, this should totally unfaze him. He should not be fazed by this in any way, shape, or form.
Right, yeah, but...
Thoughts, Nat, revisiting this. Like, I was pretty floored when I first read this and found out that Snape was the half-blood prince, because, again, that's for his, you know, ideologies of pure-blood supremacy that doesn't jive with, you know, wanting to highlight that aspect about himself. So I remember being really shocked when this happened. And it's also just the way it's written, because it's revealed after Dumbledore is killed. So it's just like, who cares now? Like they build this all up. Who is it? Who is it? Who is it? But just the timing of when it's revealed, it's just like, at this point, inconsequential.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that when he first wrote this, it was at a time, I think, when he was not so much too influenced about the Death Eaters, but wanted to be something more, I guess. So that's why he placed himself as, like, the Half-Blood Prince. Seems like gives himself, like, this very important title, but he still didn't say, like, I guess he didn't share with other people, like, look at all these potion things that I found out by myself that, like, it can make your potions better. And look at all these, you know, spells that I created that, you know, he didn't really, although I don't know how James would have found out about his spells. But anyway, I don't think he was very much publicized. I mean, he wouldn't openly, especially not in a room full of Slytherins, being like, oh yeah, I'm the Half-Blood Prince. They'll be like, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, because Snape is like, don't scream, Snape. His face was suddenly demented and human, as though he was in as much pain as the yelping, howling dog stuck in the burning house. Call me coward.
I just felt bad for Fang there. I was like, get over it, Snape. Poor puppy.
I mean, what astounds me, and I completely missed that, like, the first few times that I read, and I just, that's the beauty of coming back and reading over and over again. You just pick up on different things.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that he actually, like, hit Harry with a spell that slashed him across his face, it's horrible. I mean, you couldn't expect any less from a...
And again, violent enough that, you know, Harry did not, you know, Buckbeak was very much Sirius's pet and, you know, had, you know, it's not really portrayed as Harry having the closest relationship with Buckbeak. But when Buckbeak sees this, what's happening, it gets to a point where Harry's on the ground, like, again, from this spell, and Snape is fleeing because Buckbeak has started to attack him from the air.
Hell yeah. That's what I say to that. Like, get him, Buckbeak.
Right. I think that Buckbeak is just, you know, it's like, oh, this boy has respected me. He's always respected me. And it's like, now someone is disrespecting him. I'm going to attack him.
Yeah, he's like a
buddy of Hagrid's, too. So
Yeah, he saw Snape running as hard as he could, the enormous beast flapping behind him and screeching as Harry had never heard him screech.
Pissed.
I love him.
Yeah. Hashtag Buckbeak is awesome. And then by the time Harry kind of comes around and gets a hold of his wand again, he turns around and he realizes Buckbeak is just circling around like the entrance and realizes that Snape was able to reach the perimeter, the gate of Hogwarts, and disapparate outside the boundaries of the school.
Like a bitch.
Like a bitch. I thought you were going to say it like a boss.
No. Like a bitch. Never. Like a little bitch. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. And then Harry goes to Hagrid and Fang was rescued.
Thank God, because I was stressed about that. I really was. I was like, oh my God, are we going to kill Fang too, please? And no.
No, Fang is good, and then they start.
Oh, sorry, but you know when Hagrid's saying, "Oh, I was binding up a couple of bow truckle legs," and I was like, "The poor bow truckles, mm-hmm. they were inside the house
catching fire."
Yeah,
poor
things. Yes, poor things. R.I.P. Cute bow truckles. Yep, and so they use again another reemergence of the Aguamenti charm because we got Aguamenti last time where he was trying to fill the cup and it wouldn't work. And so he had to feed Dumbledore disgusting zombie ice water.
Yeah. Ugh.
And so now we're using Aguamenti again to, you know, put out the fire. And Harry tries to tell Hagrid what happened. And Hagrid is just like, you got knocked on the head a little too hard, Harry.
Yeah, because Hagrid's like, oh, well, Dumbledore, come, the house will be fine. And Harry's like, ooh.
Yeah, you know, Dumbledore would have told Snape to run off with them to keep his cover.
No.
Yep. And then, you know, they first start walking, like, to the front gate of the school. But then Hagrid takes notice that there are some people congregating at the foot of the astronomy tower.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Wonder what. And so we get, so Hagrid starts steering them over there, and Harry heard Hagrid's moan of pain and shock, but he did not stop. He walked slowly forward until he reached the place where Dumbledore lay and crouched beside him. He had known there was no hope from the moment that the full body bind curse Dumbledore had placed on him lifted, knowing that it could not have happened only because its caster was dead. Dumbledore's eyes were closed, but for the strange angle of his arms and legs, he might have been sleeping. Harry reached out, straightened the half-moon spectacles upon the crooked nose, and wiped a trickle of blood from the mouth. He's so sad.
God, I know. I guess this was like them, like, because you're, I think, for a moment, it's like, maybe he could survive it. I mean, like, you just, there's that little hope.
This ain't no Disney movie.
I think, you know, just before that, but this is just like, no. He's gone. Like, it's just, we're showing the body here.
Mm-hmm. And what has fallen out of Dumbledore's pocket is the locket that he grabbed, you know, while he was fending off the zombies with the fire. And yeah. Harry realizes it's not the same size, nor does it have the same markings as the Slytherin locket he remembers seeing in all the memories. And so there's a little piece of parchment folded up and wedged between in the locket where a portrait should be, and it reads thusly. To the Dark Lord, I know I will be dead long before you read this, but I want you to know that it was I who discovered your secret. I have stolen the real Horcrux and intend to destroy it as soon as I can. I face death in the hope that when you meet your match, you will be mortal once more. R.A.B. So, what do you think of this, Jess, that for all that, and it wasn't even the real goddamn Horcrux?
I feel like Harry in that moment where he's like, I'll deal with this shit later. I'm too sad. Like, that was my first reaction. But, I was trying to remember if I knew the initials R.A.B. or not. And I think it has been encountered before. Am I right in the, with the prophecy? Or am I thinking of something else?
With prophecy, it was Trelawney's initials with Dumbledore's initials.
Oh, okay. So these initials are new, right? Because that's what I got hung up on. I'm like, shit, who is this?
seeing them written like that is new, but have we met any characters with those initials? Or have we met any RB characters where maybe where we're unsure of their middle initial?
So Remus, Albus, and who's the B? I don't know. That's my...
It could be three.
Yeah. And the B, I can't figure out. One of the little bone trickles. I'm kidding. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a bummer.
Dr. R.M. Bowtruckle.
Yeah, there we go. I was just, honestly, I was like, I know I was trying to sound like I was being flip, but I was for a second. I was like, okay, who are these initials? But honestly, like, this has just been too much. And I'm also thinking of the state of Hogwarts. Like, okay, now we have just got mass chaos. Like, who's in, what is going to happen next? So, and then I don't know because I can't read the second chapter until we discuss it. So I will find out soon.
Yeah. Alrighty then. And did you have any further thoughts, Nat, before we move on to our various exercises?
No, it's just, yeah, it was just, I don't know, it's a question for Jess, like, did you ever think, damn it, you know, if Dumbledore wasn't so weakened by all this adventure, because this was, like, all for nothing, basically, if he wasn't so weakened, he would have been able to be, like, in top shape and defend himself.
There is part of me that kind of feels like he knew this is how this was going to play out. Like, I trust his intelligence too much. Like, I've never thought Dumbledore did anything haphazardly. Like, we talked about the Room of Requirement and how that seemed a little strange, but as far as his own life, you know, like, I feel like this was all very intentional. I just cannot believe that Dumbledore was like, well, shit, I'm gonna drink this stuff, you know. I feel like this was all unfortunate, but, and maybe I think he has Trelawney's powers of, like, looking into the future or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but I really don't, I think he knew it was close to the end, and obviously there's some sort of agreement between there. Snape is an asshole, but I still trust that Dumbledore was like, you know, I trust him completely. And I think it was very deliberate that we don't know what Dumbledore's reaction was at the end. Like, just please. But it was never, I didn't listen to this. I read it and it doesn't indicate how he spoke those words. So it's kind of like, you know, anyway.
I mean, it does kind of mention that Harry was terrified by the way that Dumbledore spoke because he was pleading.
Yes. But in which way was he pleading? We don't know yet. We don't know if it was like, please just get it over with, or please let me live. So
that is very true. That is very true.
True enough. So alrighty then. And now we move on to Gothic Geek Out. So, Jess, what was your Gothic Geek Out moment?
I'm going to go with one of my favorite things is just some good old Gothic horror and, you know, the Fenrir Greyback, and just kind of the grotesqueness of him. We've had some grotesque moments, but as far as a werewolf has kind of been with Lupin, was kind of softened, you know, like, everybody mm-hmm. loved Lupin. He's a great dude. This guy sucks, and he's your more traditional, like, nasty werewolf. So that was my Gothic horror moment. I love a Gothic horror moment. And
yeah. And with the name Fenrir, I believe Fenrir stems from Norse mythology. I have a huge ass book on Norse mythology and lore that I haven't even cracked open yet. But I think Fenrir was either a wolf or a werewolf, like man werewolf within the Norse canon, if my memory serves correctly.
Creepy. Honestly, I almost didn't do these because I was like so upset earlier today. I was like, I can't even do this. This is like, what's the point? But anyway, I just wanted to say that it's a miracle that I got these down.
Yes.
Anyway.
Nat, what was your Gothic geek out?
Oh, I was going to say Fenrir too. You know, mostly like the blood down his chin. That's when like they describe like the first thing that they see is like the blood of his chin. But I also have another one, which you'll probably have mentioned this before back in book four when you first saw it. But the dark mark with the serpent coming out of its mouth is, and you know, the serpent has very gothic snakes gothic connotations, right? So
yes,
I mean, you guys are the expert, not me. But yeah.
Yeah, because of, again, we never ended up doing that episode, but yeah, the Christian demonization of snakes and how that very much has, you know, penetrated the wizarding world, and they hold the same prejudices in regards to snakes. But yeah, that is a good one. Again, just the sense of, I know you haven't read it, Nat, so I won't give away too much, but there is a certain element of snake symbolism that comes up in Mexican Gothic when you get around to it.
Okay. So. Perfect. I mean, I hate snakes. I have phobia of them, so this will be fun for me to read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. And then my personal Gothic geek out was kind of a random one, but I don't know. It's the one that just came to me. Again, everything being set on fire. Yeah. You know, Hagrid's hut being set on fire, the huge mansion fire that happens at the end of a not insignificant number of houses and whatever in a variety of Gothic novels. Yeah. Jane Eyre is one, of course, where it burns down because crazy ass wife escapes, and I don't know what the hell she was thinking, but of more modern, you know, it happens in Rebecca, where it's kind of presumed that, I always read it in Rebecca, that it was the groupie housekeeper, set it on fire once they realized, like, that his name was getting cleared and that Rebecca's name was going to get damaged. In modern Gothic novels, my favorite, you know, house fire, mansion fire, is the one in, hope I'm not spoiling for either of you, I think you've both read it, The Silent Companions.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I haven't, but that's okay. I haven't read. There's so many things to read and watch and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Silent Companions by Laura Purcell. That was a very poignant example, which I really enjoyed. I didn't feel like, oh, it's just a. It didn't feel like it made sense why the fire was happening, rather than just, oh, this is a Gothic novel, we have to have the fire.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Oh, and it was in that's great. I can't remember the name of the book or the name of the author, but it's that one that Amy that you I think you sent it to me or recommended to me, but the
Marina?
Yes, that I cried at the end, yes.
Oh yeah.
That is it. Yeah, that it was like sort of at the end, right? There was a fire as well in the
fire in the theater place where the crazy ass animatronic puppets were, some crazy shit.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, I highly recommend it. Also, again, that written by Carlos Ruiz Zafón, my absolute favorite. A true example of really classic Hispanic magical realism.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah. So yeah, just fire always being the go-to to symbolize like chaos, both of the situation and the chaos of the mind crumbling and facing one's demons.
True.
Indeed.
Oh, sorry to interrupt. I have like 24 minutes on my battery life. just so you know, in case like this goes dark, I'm like,
yeah. Do you want to? You can grab your charger if you want.
It's all the way upstairs. It's just
okay. Well, I don't think
we should be fine.
Yeah. Okay. So moving on, we have the first time that I did not pick a tarot card at random because the name of the chapter was after a very specific tarot card, and this is the first time Harry the writer has called upon the allegory and any allusions whatsoever to the tarot, which, you know, there's plenty of allusions he makes, you know, to Greek mythology, to Shakespeare, to like all biblical, all sorts of stuff. But this is the first time that he's throwing tarot into the mix. So I think I picked the tarot card, the tower card at random once for another chapter, but we'll revisit again. Very poignant for this chapter where it's like, you know, that, even without reading a more detailed example, the tower card always means change, but not in the nice way. It always means the chaos, tumultuous, tempestuous level of change that is literally, again, it's more commonly referred to as as the Tower card, but the reason it's called the Lightning Struck Tower, because literally the traditional imagery and the original like Rider Ride deck is the lightning bolt coming down and striking the tower and setting it on fire.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, when the Tower card appears, expect the unexpected, massive change, upheaval, destruction, and chaos. It may be a divorce, death of a loved one, financial failure, health problems, natural disaster, job loss, or any event that shakes you to your core, affecting your spirituality, mentally, and physically.
I mean, it's a given in this one. I mean, it's just so much of a given the chapter is titled after it. So, R.I.P. Dumbledore.
R.I.P. Dumbledore. So, complete upheaval of Dumbledore, upheaval of, even before we know he's going to die, an upheaval of, because there's always been the sense of, it's always been portrayed to us that even when Voldemort was at the height of his power in the 70s, being a crazy anarchist terrorist, that he never was able to penetrate the boundaries of Hogwarts or attack Hogwarts in any way while Dumbledore was headmaster. So that is a new unprecedented thing that happened, that the fact that Death Eaters were able to get in on Dumbledore's watch.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yikes. It's bad news.
Yeah.
And like mass chaos at Hogwarts. That's why I just keep thinking, like, now that Dumbledore's gone and the Death Eaters are there, like, what is going to become of Hogwarts?
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So yeah, any further thoughts, Nat?
No, I think, yeah, it's perfectly explained on the card. It's like, you know, Harry, the author, has, you know, like, oh, this is an interesting card. Mm-hmm. Let me just read what it's about, and literally wrote that down.
Literally wrote that down, because it happens at a tower, at the tallest tower in Hogwarts, the Astronomy Tower.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, just huge upheaval. The best way forward is to let this structure self-destruct so you can rebuild and refocus. And let's be real, with a card like the Tower, you have no choice but to surrender to the destruction and chaos, no matter how unwanted or painful. The vibe of the tower card is that this level of chaos and change is inevitable, and to just fight it would only bring you further distress and discomfort. So you just gotta fucking deal and rise from the ashes.
Fox is okay, as far as we know, right?
As far as we know, yes.
Okay, because I know he showed up for a second, and I was like, oh, shit. I hope he's still here. Okay, sorry. Rise from the ashes, Phoenix. You know.
No. Yeah. Alrighty then, and now I'm picking a card at random from my Dark Moon Astrology, and let's see. And I chose Mercury Retrograde, Reinvention. So it's card number 51. So let me find that. Let's see. Mercury Retrograde is regarded as a time when things tend to go wrong. In actuality, it marks a 3.5-week period where an important action should be postponed. About 3 or 4 times a year, Mercury goes through a motion called retrograde, which means to go back or retreat. But although Mercury, the planet of slippery wit, fluency, not adaptability, this inner planet, so close to the sun, appears to be going backwards. It's not. The retrograde movement of a planet is just an illusion because the Earth is orbiting the sun at a different speed than Mercury and the other planets. Still, from an astrological point of view, planets in retrograde motion cause potent effects on the Earth below. No planet goes retrograde as often as Mercury because it is never more than 28 degrees from the sun. And because of this, it has given us the dubious phrase that when something goes awry, many exclaim, Mercury must be in retrograde. Because again, this is, even for someone who has the most minimal knowledge of astrology, even they understand that Mercury in retrograde is the time where all those things go wrong, where technology breaks down, where travel plans are disrupted, just everything is supposed to go wrong during Mercury retrograde. And yeah, Mercury isn't a predictable planet going along its normal direct path, but once it goes retrograde, all things ruled by Mercury suddenly begin to wobble and go off kilter. So, and that means, again, because Mercury is, you know, from the Greek god Hermes, so about communication, so it's a lot of miscommunication that goes on mm-hmm. and strife because of miscommunication, which, again, I don't know if it's right to be labeled as miscommunication. Yeah, or certain omission, maybe, of communication on Dumbledore's part to Harry.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
that's an always thing, a forever thing between Harry and Dumbledore.
Mm-hmm.
Not anymore. He's mm-hmm. gone.
I know. First, when this card is up in a reading, back up all of your equipment, your computers, cell phone numbers, an address book, and anything to do with technology or mechanics, electrical appliance purchase that this time may end up needing to be returned. Any sales items will often turn out to be massive duds. Don't make the mistake of purchasing a vehicle at this time either. If you are to have your vehicle repaired, expect making another visit to the shop to have something revised or corrected. So yeah, basically just Mercury retrograde is always things going wrong. And this is the most wrongest thing that ever beheld Harry at Hogwarts.
True that, yeah. True that. Mm-hmm. Everything that would go wrong and the re part I've always heard is like reread, re whatever during retrograde, and there were some drops in communication here, I guess. So
yes, any other thoughts, Nat?
No, I guess Mercury in retrograde, everything goes wrong. It's like, you know, Dumbledore dies, but then is also betrayed, and then he also finds out that all of this, everything that they went through, was all for nothing because the Horcrux was actually a fake. So it's like one thing after the other, and then he still hasn't found out who has died, right? So
right.
Who else has died? Because he found like two dead bodies with their face down in blood. So he still hasn't found out who they are.
Yeah. Ugh. So. Good cards for, you know, tarot cards and other cards of the day. And now we move on to our final exercise, fan fiction time.
Are you leaving?
Oh, no, I'm just like, okay.
That's you're dancing.
I'm just dancing.
Yeah. So Nat, what was your fanfic what if?
So I was thinking, because I'm not very imaginative, you see, I'm awful at telling stories. But mine is kind of like, what if Malfoy actually did kill Dumbledore?
That was mine too.
Oh, there you go. I think you have a better, like, you know, way forward for that. But it's like, how would he have dealt with the repercussions of that? Like, would he have felt just chill about it, or would he be terrified that he'll be persecuted basically by everyone else that it was on Dumbledore's side, or would his soul just be like basically infected with this horrible thing that he has done, right? Because I guess killing someone, not that I have done, by the way, that's what a killer would say as well. It kind of poisons your soul.
Mm-hmm. And especially in this universe, because as we learned from the Horcrux Slughorn memory, like the act of murder is put like on like the evil pedestal of that is the ultimate act of evil, enough that it can you can engage in this type of super dark magic of creating a Horcrux by committing murder. So it's literally mm-hmm. described by Slughorn that murder rips the soul apart.
Mm-hmm.
Which the Horcrux thing is not a very well-known thing, and kind of like intentionally so, right?
Yeah, like it's this ain't well-known. Like this ain't hot D.
Yeah. That's there we go. Well, Malfoy. If I may, I don't know if you wanted to continue on or if I should throw my 2 cents in, because I picked that please, as well.
Please let the 2 cents be thrown.
So because of the kind of like the act, I wonder, well, so I was thinking the repercussions for Malfoy for not doing it, because there was a kind of a promise that was made at the very beginning of the book that he would like do this. I think it was very like he's dishonored Voldemort in a way by not going through with it.
Yeah. So I guess the question is can Draco, the fact that Draco didn't kill Dumbledore, can Draco, and by extension, the Malfoy family, can they ride on the level of happiness that Voldemort is going to feel just by the fact that his most ultimate thorn in his side and the person that has prevented him from taking over completely is now finally dead? So I guess it's the question of, again, and the fact that he didn't expect Draco to really accomplish it. I guess it's a sense of how much of a power play does he want to play on the Malfoys? And it's a sense of, are the Malfoys still useful to Voldemort enough for him to extend quote-unquote mercy, even though Draco technically didn't do what he was told?
I mean, I guess we'll see, because it's kind of like, I feel like, you know, it could also be perceived as a lack of loyalty. You know, allegiance to him, like Snape had to go and clean up his, you know, after him. I guess it's dependent on the mood of Mr. Voldemort. And it seems like there are a lot of things there. So let's hope he's feeling charitable.
Because I imagine his moons are as tumultuous as my red wave that the Republicans wish they had had.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah. What was yours, Amy?
I have a few. Actually, did not go for the actual Draco committing the deed. Is what if Snape had not killed Dumbledore? I didn't fill in the gaps of whether, like, Draco did it. Like, what if, I guess, again, is there any way of Dumbledore getting out of this? I guess another one I had is, what if Snape tried to kill Dumbledore and Double D dodges, and somehow he's able to summon enough energy to, like, properly defend himself and send all the Death Eaters running, then what?
Well, we still got some bodies to deal with, though, for sure. I mean,
yeah, so we still have bodies. So the sense of what Harry, you're like, what would happen from that? Like, the fact that, for what would it mean for Harry, the fact that Snape tried?
I mean, that would get him an Azkaban, probably, right? I mean, let's say, like, everything went fine, and, like, that, well, fine. And there's not, I mean, I don't know. It's confusing because, you know, we have that, like, I trust Snape completely, but still, he's, like, trying to kill somebody who used one of the unforgivable curses, so.
Yeah. Yes. And then another one I had is, what if Harry had been able to kill Snape? Like, what if, you know, by a stroke of luck or misluck, however you frame it, what if he was able to slash Snape with Sectum Sempra and just let Snape bleed to death, and he just did not care?
He would regret that afterwards, I think. You know, Harry is not want to be vindictive, I think.
I think in the moment he would have been like, hell yeah, and then you've been like, oh shit, what did I do?
Yeah. And because it would be the question of, yeah, if he specifically Sectum, like, Sempra, because that technically it's not, again, how do you interpret, like, again, the agency, indirect or indirectly? Because if it's Sectum Sempra, you're just bleeding him to death, or you're not just throwing the killing curse of you know, just killing him all at once. And I guess the implication would be that Harry, again, in the moment, Harry'd be like, hell yeah, but he's the only one besides the Death Eaters who witnessed Snape kill Dumbledore. So would he be able to get out of, you know, would he be believed that Snape had killed Dumbledore by the other people?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. It's hard to think about because it's such a question with Snape and Dumbledore and kind of like how that all played out. We lost Nat, by the way.
Yes, we did lose Nat again. I've known never to trust, you know, oh, it'll be enough time because, again, of my own situations. Because, again, just Zencastr and just recording, it just takes a lot of energy. But luckily, we were able to get through, you know, her fanfics, you know. So, yeah, she made it for 98.5% of the podcast.
Good enough.
Yeah. Did you have any more fanfics you wanted to discuss?
No, I mean, that was really my big one. I mean, it's such, like I said, I couldn't even almost write one because I was so jarred by this. I was like, I can't even properly think about this. I mean, there's just like, there's two more chapters left. that we're going to read in this book. And then there's an entire, I mean, I'm sure the next book will deal with the fallout from all of this. So,
yeah. All righty then. Again, if not were here, we would wish her, you know, thank you. I would say, you know, we're so grateful that she came on board, and we look forward to having her back probably for some episode of book 7, The Deathly Hallows. But for next week, we're not quite there yet. We have to contend with the final chapters of Half-Blood Prince, which is chapters 29 and 30, The Phoenix Lament, and The White Tomb. And then we will be done with the 6th.
Thank you for listening to The Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks.
That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.